All right, everyone, it's Monday, October 28th, 2019. This is Arnie Arneson and The Attitude. My producer, Ken Barnes, is at the J Street Convention in Washington, D.C. Those are those sort of liberal progressive Jews who actually on occasion can say that Israel makes mistakes. It's kind of unusual, but actually not for J Street. Weather, rain, overcast, cool. Send it to California. Rain, overcast, cool. Send it to California. I am like distraught. And in fact, I'm going to begin the show as soon as I get my guests on for Rethink the Week with the last cell phone message from my friend in Humboldt County. I hope it works, but I want you to hear it because it sort of speaks to the moment of what's happening in California, which is making me completely apoplectic. So I just wanted to share that with you. I also wanted to let you know that on Thursday, I spoke to a group of adults. I'd say they were all over the age of 65, probably about 100 of them. And it was a sort of a conversation, a two-hour conversation with, by the way, Dean Spiliotis, about the 2020 campaign and about sort of just about politics in America. It was really lovely. It was Nancy West of In-Depth New Hampshire, which is an online newspaper that's sort of, you know, a nonprofit concept. As our newspapers are beginning to sort of disappear right in front of our eyes, we need someone to do the local journalism that is so crucial for our knowledge of our state and our communities. And then as we process what's happening at the national level, Dean Spiliotis, by the way, he was so fabulous. Someday I just have to let him sort of teach a class that he teaches at Southern New Hampshire University and just teach it for us, because it was the first time I actually got to hear him. Not that he doesn't do complete sentences, but he was able to talk for about 15 minutes about what he's covering in his classwork, because he's a presidential scholar, and it was just so informative. So I actually got to learn at a lecture that I actually created. But the other thing I wanted to tell you was, so I'm at this event, and there's about 100 adults, and I have been called a lot of things in my life because I've been a progressive, liberal, former New Yorker, run for governor and Congress person for a long time. So everyone knows I'm a politician in recovery, but everybody knows my political opinions. And I've been called a lot of things. But for the first time ever on Thursday, I was called something I've never been called before. And I thought I would share this with you. I was called a San Francisco liberal. Wow. And I'm thinking, maybe he knows Nancy Pelosi. I don't know Nancy Pelosi, but maybe is that what he means? I wanted to sort of ask him, but I thought, no, that would take up too much time from something that I was trying to have a conversation about. But I just thought that was kind of interesting in a lot of ways. And I'm going to do this. We are being joined right now by phone by two people, one I know and one I don't. Jeff Feingold is the award-winning editor for the New Hampshire Business Review. And Jeff, how long have you been writing for different journalist outlets in New Hampshire, just so people get a sense of the fact that you are long in the tooth and you have incredible you have incredible institutional memory.
I just got my Medicare card the other day.
Well,
so
see, you're a little bit.
I'm in the promised land.
That's right. You have Medicare for all. You just
Medicare
have to be 60.
For all for me.
Yeah, for you. Yeah, for you. You and Pete Buttigieg. You should tell him that's what the new line should be. Now, how long have you been writing in New Hampshire for different media outlets?
Since January 1981.
Wow.
So that's a long time.
That is a long time.
I need to sit down now.
No, you do. I was graduating from law school in the summer of 1981, but I had moved to New Hampshire in 1980. So that's what I remember. And my earliest memory, of course, of New Hampshire is that my ex-husband went to work for the most reactionary governor in U.S. history at that time, a former governor by the name of Governor Meldrum Thompson,
mm-hmm.
who makes Governor LePage look liberal. When you think about Mel Thompson, he really was a precursor for all the things that we've seen happen the last couple of years. It's kind of interesting.
I had the opposite experience when as a reporter. I worked in New Jersey before then, and I remember I got an assignment and said I was given his phone number. Just call the governor and ask him for his opinion. And I was on. They were going to have snowmaking at Sunapee before they had snowmaking, so I was going to talk to the governor about it. So I was trained
from New Jersey,
in a big state like New York, New Jersey, and so I call. And I suddenly answered the phone. I said, hello, I'd like to speak to the governor. And it was Hugh Gallon. He said, this is the governor.
No, Hugh Gallon answered the phone?
Yeah.
Well.
And now, fast forward 38 years, and we have still have not been able to get a a comment from the governor on any of our stories, the current governor, because he won't return our phone calls.
Well, there you go. He's now in the new sort of political milieu we're living in. Joining us right now from Iowa State is the chair of the political science department from Iowa State, Mac Shelley. Welcome to the program. You can sort of tell this is the feel of the show, Mac.
Okay. It's fun.
It is fun. So can you make a phone call to the governor of Iowa and have some kind of a relationship or contact? I mean, I know you're not in the media like Jeff, but you are obviously a political science professor. But you know there's an intimacy, I imagine, about Iowa. Is that actually true, or is that more like how you sell the state?
Well, I don't have Governor Kim Reynolds on speed dial, but I probably could get a hold of her if I needed to in a pinch. You know, Iowa is the quintessential retail politics state.
Yeah.
That's what the Iowa caucuses are all about. And so, you know, there's kind of a joke that works pretty well in Iowa and New Hampshire. You may have heard it.
Yeah.
You ask somebody, you're going to vote for candidate X. Said, well, I've only met him 3 or 4 times. So I haven't formed an opinion yet.
Yeah.
I mean, I try to explain to people here that in, like, California, you'd be lucky to be within 100 miles of a candidate.
Exactly.
So we get kind of spoiled here.
You are. We're both very spoiled. And just before we get into our conversation, I was just sent a new book. You know, a lot of publicists send me books because, obviously, how many people, like, cover politics and cover books that most people might find boring? But listen to the title of this one, you guys. It's a book about Machiavelli. Ready? Machiavelli, The Art of Teaching People What to Fear. Wow. Pretty amazing. All right. So I want to do something I've never done before, gentlemen. And I'm going to begin the show. You saw when I sent you a lot of information that one of the things I wanted to talk about was what's happening right now in California because of the incredible wildfires, which touch on 1,000 different issues, not just climate change, not just a response to these outrageous, you know, hundreds and thousands of acres that are now basically being burnt, and how we respond to it both as a state, as a nation, and what does it mean for our future. So I received a voice message from a friend, and I'm going to try to do something I've never done before. I want to play it on the air. She lives in Humboldt County, everyone, and this is her last voice message before they cut the power out from PG&E, all right? So here is how it begins.
We're filling the oil lamps and getting ready for the return to the dark ages. My phone battery is so beat that I cannot use the phone once the power goes out because it won't hold a charge. There will be a charging station I can visit, so if I had an emergency, I'd be able to use it. But otherwise, no phone, no internet, and it's supposed to last till Tuesday. So as soon as it's over, I'll call you. But everything's fine. We have everything we need, and we have water and heat. So it's just the way it is these days in California. Climate change is here.
Wow.
So talk to you on Tuesday. Love you.
All right, everyone. So that was her last voice message. They're filling the oil lamps. She has to go to an emergency station. And she's lucky. She's lucky. So I'm going to start with you, Mac. And that is that this is a story that touches on so many different levels. It's a story about PG&E. Because they're making decisions now to act proactively by cutting off power to millions of people in California, in part because they've been accused of starting, for example, the Camp Fire, which I think cost $16 billion. That's how much they figure the cost of just that one fire in 2018 was. And to give you to give you a little perspective, I use this in my talk on Thursday, was that in 2017, listen to this, Jeffrey, in 2017, the entire cost of fires in the United States was $17 billion. In 2018, the Camp Fire was $18 billion. That was just one. And now they're saying this fire now is the largest fire ever in California history. So I guess I'm going to start with you because Mac, you are both a statistician, you're a political science professor. How do we approach this on a level that we can comprehend? Because this is, in part, synergistic. It's about, you know, the failure to do the adequate investment that PG&E should have made. It's the fact that people have now moved into very sort of rural forested areas, because as it becomes more and more expensive and as people have the opportunity, they move into places that are more remote. It is about climate change and what happens as a result of climate change. It is about that it's California and the federal government, because of Donald Trump, doesn't necessarily like California. It is about where do these people, when they're told to leave, where do they go? I mean, where do you have like hundreds of thousands of people that are told to leave their homes? I just got to ask you, there aren't enough Airbnbs and hotel rooms to take them. So as we look at all that, what does this say from a political science perspective? And how do we sort of prepare for a future that is not the future? It's happening right now, Mac.
The future is now. In this case, that's not a good thing. I think one really important aspect of this is the nexus between private and public ownership.
Yes.
Private ownership of electrical grid is pretty standard. There's public regulation of it, but that comes after the fact. And
right.
So PG&E is not the same as the California government. They sort of intertwine a bit.
Yep.
But you do wonder how different things would be if, if these were publicly owned utilities rather than regulated, privately owned ones. The national electrical grid, the power grid in general, is pretty rickety, and a lot of it dates back to the 50s, if not
right.
before. And it's kind of teetering on the brink. You know, we've had major blackouts on the East Coast before, and
right.
now we have the wildfire-related forced blackouts in California. So it's not just California, but basically nationally, we have a power system that is kind of on the brink of collapse. Climate change is pushing it there very quickly. And if anybody ever doubted that climate change was a real thing, it certainly doesn't seem like a Chinese hoax right now.
Well, I'm going to say, Dean Spilioris has just come in. Dean Spilioris is a civic scholar and a presidential scholar from Southern New Hampshire University. He has a blog called nhpoliticalcapital.com. He also is a regular on New Hampshire Public Radio on their Friday show. We're obviously talking about what's going on in California. And as I'm listening to this and I'm hearing that Max Shelley is saying, you know, we have a rickety old grid and obviously it needs repair. So here's the thing I'm going to pose to you, Dean, is I believe in the democratization of energy. And you maybe heard me say that before. I think each home and every business, to the extent possible, should be their own power source. So that they should do conservation, they should do solar panels, they should put batteries in, they should do geothermal, and hell, if they can do a tiny little wind turbine, go for that as well. And part of the reason I've said that is that, one, it's probably good because it's sustainable, it's alternative, and two, it doesn't depend on the grid. So as we're looking at the story of California, do we want to spend billions and trillions of dollars of undergrounding all those electrical wires as we repair the grid? Or do we want to actually make an investment in something that is an alternative to the old rickety grid? Because the old rickety grid is based on a past that I don't think is sustainable going into the future. Dean?
Hi. It's a great public policy question.
It is an important one.
Huge implications for
yes.
the expenditure of public resources. I was literally, as I was walking in here, texting with a friend of mine who teaches poli-sci at UCLA, and there's that fire right across the 405 from the campus. The campus was open today.
Oh,
but,
my God.
But this is the first time she's ever mentioned the possibility of a mandatory evacuation in that area. So
yeah.
it's just remarkable. It's really, it's become a constant problem out there. What you just describe to me the kind of the mix of energy and all the backup systems.
Yeah.
I mean, it's very appealing conceptually. You hear a lot more about, oh, we really need to put those lines underground
yeah.
as kind of an easier solution. But I think long-term, you're certainly, what you're suggesting makes sense.
Yeah.
The question is, you know, shifting the public policy bureaucracy to make that kind of a change is, you know, if it's going to happen anywhere in the states, maybe it'll be in California.
It'll be in California.
Right, right.
Right, exactly.
So maybe that starts as a laboratory, perhaps.
Well, and Jeffrey, I think we really have to talk seriously about this. First of all, if people are going to live out in rural areas, somehow getting electricity to them makes no sense. Number two, if you're going to do that, then maybe you need to figure out how to, like it's the Wild West, you know. In the old days, you didn't have a power grid. You know, you had the fire and you had the cow and you had the horse and you were able sort of to take care of yourself. And to some extent, you need to do that. But my biggest fear is if we don't do something that sort of involves all of us, Stefan Schmidt, who you know, Max Shelley, from Iowa State
mm-hmm.
as well, sent me an article. And Jeffrey, the article that he sent was very wealthy people are now talking about investing in their own firefighting team. So what we have is we're going from the gated community to now the, you know, this is the Cohen firefighting crew. It is not for the community. It's just for me. And that is my fear, is that people will check out of the sort of community investment because they can personalize it and protect themselves.
Yeah, and this has been happening, you know, it's been an ongoing problem in terms of all kinds of services. And, you know, also, you know, you have people have their own, basically their own armed guards at these gated communities.
Yes.
You have, you know, their own, fire departments. They do have these things. They do have their own, all kinds of different kinds of services. But, you know, the interesting thing to me is that I think I just get a sense that there is really a growing understanding among just ordinary people who don't pay attention to this stuff too much, that climate change is something that is a necessary thing for us to address now.
Yeah.
It's not no lip service to it. Yeah. I just up here talking to people who don't normally get engaged with this kind of stuff. And it really flipped a switch in my head was a piece in today's New York Times by David Leonhardt,
mm-hmm.
who basically said, you know, the big issue that the Democratic presidential candidates should be talking about, it's not Medicare for all, it's climate change. That's the thing that people need to be talking about. That's the thing that needs to be addressed immediately. While, you know, under the Clinton administration, the Obama administration, that was the essential topic, was health care. This is even above it in terms of, in the surveys yet in the polls, but it is something that is so important to address because, you know, it's...
I'm out of my mind.
We're running out of time.
Look
what's going on in California. You know, and you know, the hurricane season is pretty much over, but, you know, every year we go through this stuff. You look at the damage, the destruction of not just, you know, islands in the Caribbean, but in the United States, coastal areas, Houston, the Carolinas, Florida. You know, this is not stuff that it gets worse. It's not going away, and it's really an issue that... I don't know where our political leaders are on this. They just don't really seem to be paying attention not addressing it the way they should be.
Well, in the way I'm glad that we have an Iowa person representing Iowa on our radio show because Mac, one of the things that really concerns me is farmers have got to be aware of this. I mean, I was looking at the fields in Nebraska. I mean, they were underwater for like forever. They saw the kind of flooding they had never seen before. I mean, farmers keep thinking that they're angry at China. I mean, I'm thinking, I don't care about the trade war. I'm going to care about climate change because that is going to create long-term destruction. And then the question is, what will you have to sell? You know, that really becomes the problem. And the other thing I said this morning was, so I watch MSNBC and I watch CNN. When there is a hurricane, Mac, I notice it's 24/7 coverage. They're in the middle of the rain and they're like sitting there floating out to sea. This is a fire that in some ways is going to cause more damage to a place that's the size of a country called California that is so important to the economy of the United States. And we've gotten Jack, you know what, when it comes to the kind of coverage there. And I think that that is both immoral, number one. And two, as you just heard Jeffrey say, climate change should be probably front and center. But if you don't cover the fires the way they should be covered, the way you cover hurricanes, maybe people won't know we're burning and we're going underwater, and it's never happened the way it's happening now. And I guess I'm trying to figure out, would Iowa farmers embrace the idea of climate change being a number one issue? Because if nothing else, they are the most sensitive to extreme weather and to the changing weather.
Well, it's extreme weather. There are also things like changing trade economic situations on top of that. So, yeah, right now farmers are not in a very good frame of mind here in Iowa or much of the rest of the country. We don't have wildfires here, but we have 500-year floods that pop up every couple of years now.
Yeah.
The Missouri River, the west coast of Iowa, basically, is flooded the last three years in succession. It doesn't get the kind of hot and sexy kind of coverage that you would like from 24/7 media,
right.
But around here this is pretty much life and death matter. A local joke is might as well get a water buffalo and plant rice, rather than try to grow corn. We do have some beginnings of not solutions, but at least approaches to dealing with kind of this combination of climate change and the power grid situation. Iowa has one claim to fame in this regard in that we have think it's 36% now of the state's entire power supply coming from wind-driven energy.
Right.
We have wind farms all over the place.
Yeah.
Farmers aren't necessarily thrilled about having these 300-foot-tall towers with the giant spinners on them, but that's where a lot of the power comes from. Wind is essentially free. You have to pay to build this stuff, obviously, but if you can get power and wealth from the wind, that's one way of sort of dealing with both things at the same time.
Well, let me just say something about wind, though. And so, Dean, as I was thinking about, and I've been to Iowa a lot, and you're absolutely right. Between Iowa and Texas are places where you see wind farms everywhere. The beauty of wind versus oil, coal, gas, and fracking is you can still farm under a wind turbine. Okay? So as much as, Dean, people sort of bitch and moan about the visual, I'm telling you, have you ever been to a visual of of an oil field? Have you ever been to what happens? I mean, if there's an explosion at a wind turbine, one turbine goes down. If there's an explosion at an oil refinery, everything gets exploded. I mean, in a lot of ways, we don't do the cradle-to-grave analysis when we talk about the kinds of changes we need to make. And you're absolutely right. I think that Jeff was right with what Leonhard said, that we really need to talk about the climate crisis. But you know why the climate crisis and healthcare are related? When you have to lose your location and your job, you lose your healthcare. When you have to dislocate for a couple of months, you lose your income. And as long as we tie a job and healthcare together, not only will you feel vulnerable from climate change, you're going to feel vulnerable from your ability to access a doctor because of the cost situation and how you actually are provided through private insurance. So in a bizarre way, you can't really address one without understanding how the two are related.
This is the Bernie Sanders and and Elizabeth Warren argument that you're essentially locked into your job because you're concerned about your health care. That's kind of been their argument. You know, on the wind stuff, it's fascinating. New Hampshire is a great example of where, you know, there are several wind farms in the state, and I use farms loosely because we're really just talking about a collection of these, not massive farms of them. Yeah, and the process of getting those sited. It took years, site evaluation committee, neighbors, lawsuits, towns battling. The one in Antrim that they're finally building took 8 to 10 years, I think, to site. But, you know, contrast, I've traveled around Europe recently. You go to Greece or even Germany or Austria, just these vast wind farms in unpopulated areas. And that's I think you're seeing a little bit of that now. We're starting to explore offshore of New England, the one near Nantucket or Martha's Vineyard. They're talking now. I think there's an exploratory work here in New Hampshire.
Right.
Yes, exactly. Right. So that may be, given the geography here, the Midwest is a little bit different. You have these vast expanses of agricultural land, more akin to what I've seen in Europe, but it's not without controversy, for better or worse.
Okay, so
yeah,
Jeff,
actually, there's been a multi-state effort that was just announced last week by New England states to go through an offshore, you know, to try to develop offshore wind projects, but apparently there's some problems with the Trump administration, which is not being amenable to supporting it at this point, which is. You know,
no surprise.
Well,
they wanted to open up the offshore oil drilling.
Yeah, right, exactly.
It'll get in the way of the oil rigs.
Exactly. And you know, and Mac, there used to be this project that it sounds like what they were talking about in New Hampshire with Antrim. It was called Cape Wind. And Cape Wind was off Nantucket, I believe it was. And, of course, who was offended by it but all the very, very wealthy liberals? It was just so interesting. All the people that wax poetic about the environment and all these people that wax poetic about how important it is to have alternative energy, they just didn't want to see a wind turbine 14 miles out. I mean, it was
And even Northern Pass, which was very unpopular here, that was not to pipe crude oil through New Hampshire. That was to bring hydropower down from Quebec. And even that was just fought with tremendous ferocity.
Okay, so Jeffrey, I want to end with this because as we're talking about, you know, the fires in California, we're talking about the Trump administration, we're talking about alternative energy, I want to bring in the security piece because someone sent this to me last week and I posted it as part of our conversation. U.S. military could collapse within 20 years due to climate change. This is a report commissioned by the Pentagon. The report says a combination of global starvation, war, disease, drought, and a fragile power grid – there we go, boys and girls – could help cascading, devastating effects. I have been literally saying this, Jeffrey, for the last 5 years. And people look at me like I'm a total nutcase. And now I see this happening. This is the story. I mean, how is the Trump administration going to deal with this when it's coming out from their own Pentagon?
Well, this is not new. I mean, the Pentagon has been very much on following this issue of climate change. They know how it affects the military around the world. They've known for well over a decade, actually. And the Trump administration will follow through the way it has been, by burying these things, by ignoring these words. They don't take this seriously. It's not actually taking it seriously. Not taking it seriously is a mild way to say how they have contempt for people who discuss climate change, who talk about the issue. And it's really disturbing. I mean, you know, the president himself exhibits willful ignorance every minute of the day, pretty much. But for people who are supposedly in policymaking roles, who pretend that this is not happening or try not to, just they're in denial. At best, they're in denial. It's disturbing. It is. I mean, when you know that the Pentagon of all places, you know, this is like, you know, we talked about this years ago on your show.
I know. The
insurance,
this is not Mother Jones commissioning this.
The insurance industry has been on this for
years,
more than a decade.
I know.
They know what's going on.
All right, I need to end this segment. But let me just read this. This report, by the way, was commissioned by General Mark Milley, Trump's new chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. So this isn't done by the Obama administration. He can't sit there and say, "Oh, it's all those lefties from Obama." And this is even more amazing. The senior U.S. government officials who wrote the report are from, are you ready, everyone? Key agencies, including the Army, the Defense Intelligence Agency, NASA. The study called on the Pentagon to urgently prepare for the possibility that domestic power, water, and food systems might collapse due to the impacts of climate change as we near mid-century. Mid-century. And this is not the end of the century. This is 2050. And I just think, so, you know, Mac, as we're hearing this, have you heard the 2020 candidates holding up the Pentagon reports? So, Mac, Martin O'Malley has given a talk on climate change, all right? It's 2015. And I go to hear the talk in Concord, New Hampshire. And this, I swear to God, this is exactly what I did. When he got done, I walked up to two of his staffers and I said, "He sounds too granola." And they looked at me and they went, "Granola?" And I said, "Yeah." I said, "He needs to muscle it up." I said, "He needs to start pulling out the Pentagon reports on this." Because one of the things they suggest is the reason why Syria has this incredible war and the situation in Syria was because of climate change and the famine and the farmers who had to leave because it was so devastated by the drought that they moved into the cities. The cities couldn't handle the movement and the migration. And as a result, you saw what happened in Syria. And sure enough, the next day he started talking about making the connection to both domestic and international concerns from an intelligence and security perspective, and everybody made fun of him. So I'm kind of curious, have you heard any of the 2020 candidates holding up sort of the Pentagon as a raison d'etre for this issue?
Well, of the 2020 Democratic candidates, I think it's fair to say that Tom Steyer has probably made this more of a centerpiece of his campaign.
Yeah.
It hasn't, you know, resonated terribly well, but at least in terms of recent polling. But he's hanging in there. He's an independent billionaire, so he can afford to keep going about as long as he wants to.
Yeah.
But that has been a signature theme, other than impeaching Trump.
And before that, it was the governor, what was it, of Washington or Oregon or whatever, Jay Inslee, who made it his issue. And in some ways, he was a man before his time, and it was only about, 3 months. But
to that point, Gary Hirschberg, who, I know that he's a well-known person in New Hampshire and actually in a lot of
Stonyfield circles. Yogurt, for those who want to know.
Stonyfield Farm Yogurt and all that stuff. He's been trying to hold a series of meetings or forums with presidential candidates to discuss climate change.
Right. And this week I think it's going to be
held
Tom
one
Steyer.
The other day, and Tom Steyer and Michael Bennett showed up. He tried to hold one about a month ago and they had to cancel it because the candidates one showed up.
Oh, my God.
So this is what my point is, that, it's like I think the Democrats are being foolish for ignoring this issue, because I talk to young people all the time,
and
this is what they talk about.
All right, I need to take a break.
And that's something you have to remember, and I'm sure people at colleges know this better than I do.
Absolutely. This is a Rethink the Week on The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. We have a little labor history, and we'll be back.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1861. That was the day that the Pony Express made its last run and passed into legend. The mail delivery service had lasted only a year and a half until it folded under competition from the newly completed Transcontinental Telegraph. The idea for a faster Western mail delivery service came from the owners of the wagon freight company, Russell, Majors & Waddle. At the time, the railroad terminated in St. Joseph, Missouri. The goal of the Pony Express route was to cover the 2,000-mile route from St. Joe to San Francisco in 10 days, or half the time of competitors. Riders would travel between one station and another on horseback, switching horses as they went. For this arduous job, the company targeted young men, sometimes in their teens. The goal was to hire small men to keep the weight low for the horses. The riders had to sign a pledge not to drink, gamble, fight, or swear. To back up the clean living, they were each issued a Bible. Riders were paid a minimum of $50 per month in addition to room and board. The riders faced many hazards from bad weather to thieves. They often traveled across lands in dispute between the U.S. government and Native Americans, adding to the potential danger. The fastest express delivery ever was Lincoln's inaugural address, which made it to California in under 8 days. Perhaps the most famous person who claimed to be a Pony Express rider was Buffalo Bill Cody, although it's unlikely he ever carried the mail. He incorporated the Pony Express into his Wild West show, turning the mail service into the stuff of legend.
Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in Two.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. If you cause a flood that destroys someone else's home, it's considered a property rights violation.
And it shouldn't matter whether or not that's a consequence of building a dike or a dam or generating emissions that produce increases in sea level rise.
Jonathan Adler is a law professor at Case Western Reserve University.
A lot of the expected and predictable consequences of climate change are things that we recognize to be violations of property rights and have recognized as violations of property rights for centuries.
Adler says framing the issue this way could inspire more support for climate action, especially among groups that prioritize individual property rights.
If we accept that climate change is a problem, if we accept that it's causing the sorts of rights violations that libertarians normally think justify government intervention, that should shift our discussion from whether there's a case for government intervention to what type of intervention and how do we maximize the likelihood that that intervention produces the sorts of results that we're trying to get.
Like Climate Connections, subscribe to our free podcast on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
Everyone, we are back. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. Robert Cray's Consequences. God, that's totally appropriate. On our We Think the Week, we are joined by phone with Max Shelley. He is the chair of the Political Science Department at Iowa State. Also joining us by phone is the editor of the New Hampshire Business Review, Jeff Feingold. And joining us in studio is Dean Spiliotis. He is a civic scholar and a presidential scholar at Southern New Hampshire University. I do want to talk about al-Baghdadi, and I do want to talk about what happened, but But there's something else that actually I think is maybe in the long term more important. And I'm going to start with Jeff because you are the journalist in the crowd. And the reason I'm going to start with you, Jeff, stop laughing. This is an important story. So Facebook is now putting up these news tabs. So in order for people to access news and information, they sort of put there, here's where you can go. And you would sort of think that they would be really kind of like, you know, vetted newspapers that you could sort of trust. But I found out, this is kind of shocking, that they made Breitbart one of their news tabs. Now, I don't know about you, Jeffrey, but how do you feel about being, you know, on the same list as Breitbart, which I don't really see as, I mean, I know it produces something that kind of has the illusion of news, yeah, just the way Donald Trump has the illusion of facts, but it just seems that it's so off the charts.
Yeah, you know, what it is, it's this, it's the rewards reaped by people on the right wing who have just kind of beaten down corporations and other people just to you know, that their pretend news sources are actual news sources. Like, you know, starting with Fox News, which is so-called news, it's not, it's just, you know, it's a political campaign arm, really, at this point. And same thing with Breitbart. Breitbart was, you know, was there beginning, and Drudge Report and all these organizations that pretend to be news organizations, but they're not. They have very obvious political agendas, and it's disturbing that they're able to, you know, I guess the only word that comes to my mind right now is weasel their way into this conversation. It's, you know, it's politically correct to not have to, you know, you say, well, I'm a news organization, so I don't want, you know, you can't say I'm not. You know, you've seen this all the time, people looking right for White House credentials or other kinds of credentials to covering issues. You know, the infamous James O'Keefe.
Yes.
Pretends to be a journalist.
Right.
And this is something that I think people in journalism should have been more aggressive on at the beginning, because it's really out of control now. It's not like it's gotten out of control. It is out of control.
So I want to turn to Dean. So Dean, here's my challenge. And that is, define a news outlet. And no, I mean I don't want to defend Facebook, but I'm just trying to figure out, is there a way that we can find, like, common terms? Like, I can see the Washington Post and maybe the Washington Times. So if you want to at least have a spectrum, you've got the Washington Times, you've got the Washington Post. But when you start including things like Breitbart, I'm just trying to figure out how do you draw the line, and who's in a position to draw the line? That's my biggest concern.
You know, one of the democratization of news through the internet, it's had obviously mixed results. It's a very difficult thing. As you know, we've had this conversation just recently. People, on the one hand, people are kind of hungry for things they can be comfortable are factual, but on the other hand, they also gravitate towards opinion journalism that reinforces their own pre-existing beliefs, and it's become a very gray area. You know, one person's New York Times as fact is another person's fake news. So we've reached a point now where there really are almost no arbiters. And, you know,
right,
this has always been a challenge. I can think back when I lived in Washington, D.C. This is going back 20, 25 years. I was in an apartment building. I used to come out of my building every morning, and there was a newspaper box for the Washington Post. Remember those?
Right.
A newspaper box for the Washington Times right next to each other.
Yeah.
And I would do this exercise where every morning I would read the front page of each. You would think we were in two different countries based
right
on what was on the front page.
Right.
So there's always been a kind of a massaging of perspective in the news. But when people ask me that question, you know, where do I go to get the facts?
Yeah.
When I start mentioning things.
That on Thursday.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and you say, well,
yeah,
go, the New York Times used to be the paper of record. And they're like, the New York Times, that's a left-wing paper. And so
right,
how do you respond to that?
Yeah, I
have to say part of the problem is that we've lost so many respected news organizations over the last 20 years or so, that I think there's just so few alternatives. So you've got the New York Times and you've got the Washington Post, which are, you know, obviously, you know, the top news organizations, at least in terms of print in this country.
Well, and there are places like PolitiFact, but people even accuse PolitiFact of being biased.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and I have to say that, but the thing is that it's what happens is, because there's such a dearth of news organizations, that the ones that are left standing stand out. But, you know, growing up in New York, when I was there in the 60s, when there were still six, seven papers
right Right,
you know, at one
exactly.
point, and you had a, they went ran across the political spectrum.
Right.
You know, in those days, the Daily Mirror was extremely right wing.
Yeah.
You know, the Daily News was a very conservative paper. On all the way on the left was, believe it or not, the New York Post under its previous ownership.
Yeah.
Was by far the liberal paper. That, you know, that's the paper we had in my house when I was a kid. It was the Times and the New York Post.
Right.
We weren't allowed to have the Daily News in our house. but this is the kind of, I know, and we would get the World Journal Tribune, whatever
right.
it was back
right.
then, you know, the MERS thing. But they were all news organizations. Their editorial pages were basically where the craziness was.
Right, but it didn't bleed into the front page.
And, you know, they might have chosen to cover news differently, you know, especially the tabloids. They wanted to cover the crime and all that other stuff.
Yeah.
But it was accurate. It was covered by professional journalists who cared about getting their story, and it was no interference from ownership or whatever trying to create this narrative, this false narrative. But that's not what we have anymore.
Well, we don't have firewalls anymore. So Mac, I taught mass communication. I've taught political science. I've taught gender politics. I've taught a lot of things. One of the things I assigned my students was I made them read newspapers.
Mm-hmm.
I actually made that part of my assignment. That was something I actually did when I was in high school, where my teachers made me read newspapers. But I realized that by the time I started teaching college, nobody had ever picked up a newspaper. So I decided to teach them the newspaper muscle. And I made them read newspapers, but I made them read newspapers across the political spectrum. So I had them read things like the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Christian Science Monitor, whatever it was, the Washington Times, because I wanted them to read different papers so they could understand, one, the flavor of the paper, because as you just heard from Dean Spiliotis. But my big fear is, how do your students access news? Or is it just Facebook? Is it just Twitter? Is it just Instagram?
It's not newspapers.
We talked about this.
Right.
So I'm just trying to figure out, do they care about where they go? And do they even think about whether they need to vet?
Well, if you're talking about political science majors, that's one thing. Average students, quite a different matter. Political science majors, I think, are really still steeped in the news. And we have lots of courses that are built around reading, especially the New York Times and the Washington Post. So students do get some exposure to that. They get broadcast coverage, obviously, from Fox News, MSNBC, CNN, and a bunch of others. They also rely, in fact, I do too, on news aggregators online. Google News, for whatever reason, is one I usually find pretty helpful. It covers lots of countries, for one thing, in different languages. So it gives you good exposure to international issues. And there are others like that. Real Clear Politics tries. It has a bit of a bias. But, you know, so there are things like that that we kind of tell students about if they don't know about it already. Beyond political science majors, it's a real different world. Somebody like majoring in engineering or I don't know,
exactly.
Agriculture. I think at best they're just going to get occasional snippets of things through whatever they get on their smartphones. And in that case, you're kind of subject to the whims of whoever is in a position to engage in narrow casting with them. And they're going to pick up just one particular sliver of the spectrum.
So I'm going to end this conversation just by saying that, you know, we're talking about what's happened to journalism. We're talking about the fact that there's no firewall between the editorial page, if there's even an editorial page and a front page left. And we're talking about it's very difficult to monetize it anymore. And we're now finding out that hedge funds now are sort of buying and selling papers for whatever reason, then draining the resources out of them. So they're becoming sort of, you know, a financial pool of money, but not necessarily a place to actually report on the news. I want to go back to where I think we need to go, which is not college. And that is, I was talking to a number of people the other day. They have stopped teaching social studies in a number of high schools around the state because it's not part of STEM. You know, it's not what's being tested. So even the only place where you might have had a shot at actually learning about the news, learning and making those sort of inquiries, those we're not even valuing that in high school, Dean, which is just so terrifying to me because that's a reason why you've never developed the curiosity muscle when it comes to news and information, is that basically it's never even been taught in junior high and high school. So by the time you get to college, it's all about what my job is going to be, not necessarily what my world is going to be. And I think that's frightening. That's absolutely frightening. All right. So let me go here. So, Dean, I mentioned to you that I want to talk a little bit about the ISIS leader who was killed. And Donald Trump is now waxing poetic because al-Baghdadi blew himself up, whimpering and crying. He died after running into a dead-end tunnel, whimpering and crying and screaming all the way. Now, everyone's not quite sure that that's an accurate representation of what happened. I suspect he probably did blow himself up. I suspect he was in a tunnel. But Donald Trump is so good at the theater. It's just amazing.
Well, it's interesting to me. I was thinking about the timing of this. My understanding was that it actually happened the day before, the night before President Trump teased, he had a tweet out that said something big has happened the night before, but they decided to go live at 9 a.m. on Sunday when all the morning talk shows were locked in on it. It was certainly a big moment, much in the same way that the Obama's Osama bin Laden moment was a big moment. It's part of a much more complicated set of issues about these rapid changes in our policy in that part of the world and the bigger picture of the Kurds being displaced and Turkey and Russia becoming bigger players in Syria than they already were. But, Trump, it was sort of vintage Trump. He, as soon as I saw there was going to be a Q&A session, I thought this is going to get interesting because
46 minutes
he knew
later.
He was going to riff. The whole thing was over an hour.
I know. It's incredible.
And people, as usual, are now spending time kind of vetting and picking apart a lot of his statements. But certainly, a triumph in terms of getting this one individual who, whether or not he was in operational control now, certainly had left in his wake just a trail of kind of atrocities.
But as someone described it, I think what Donald Trump doesn't quite understand about terrorist organizations like ISIS, and Jeffrey, you can also comment on this, is that they're kind of like a hydra. You cut off one head.
There's always somebody else.
Right. And they're not. There obviously does need to be sort of a form of leadership, but leadership isn't really how they take their direction.
Well, you remember we had with Al Qaeda certainly back during the height of Afghanistan and Iraq. Yeah. They had the military had those deck of cards with all the leaders.
Yes, yes.
And you take one out of the deck, and then it's okay. Now the number three guy is now the number two guy.
Yes,
I mean, there's always somebody. It's always shifting.
We got number two about 22 times.
Yeah, and then they move up. Right. There's always somebody else to take
exactly,
the place.
Exactly. So, Jeffrey, I just want to remind everyone that Trump thanked Russia, Syria, Turkey, and Iraq for their help in conducting the attack. Oh, and he also happened to
–
he also managed to thank the Syrian Kurds. Now, the reason I mention this is that listen to this behind-the-scenes comment that came in earlier, right after we found out about this. Earlier, the commander of the Kurdish-led Syrian Democratic Forces said he called the operation an historic, successful operation, which had resulted from joint intelligence work with the U.S. So here's my question. What exactly did Russia, Syria, and Turkey do that, in fact, you probably could point to? Because I have a funny feeling this has been going on for months, the preparation of this, and the Kurds were the only ones really involved in this part of the world, following what was going on in ISIS, being responsible for this. So I have a funny feeling that, maybe 80% of this is like Kurdish responsible, not necessarily Russia, Syria, Turkey, and Iraq.
Well, I guess he's thanking Russia, Syria, Turkey, and Iraq, and Iran for not attacking their people.
Yeah, maybe.
Well, they did this. But, I have to say, the other thing that really stuck out to me was that apparently he notified the Russian government, but not, Nancy Pelosi of this thing. Gave a heads up to her and supposedly came up with this Trumpian stuff that comes out of his mouth that, she was going to leak it. Or this place, she's been in the government for how many years, Dean? Yeah. I mean, basically forever.
Yeah.
And she was going to leak this information. That's just defamatory at this point to imply that. But this is how he works. I mean, it gets really tiring. I mean, I know Dean's saying he's this classic Trump and everything, but I know for me it's like I had this realization the other day. I am so tired personally of the hyperbolic adjectives and adverbs. And they're always the same. Fantastic, wonderful, the greatest, the best. It's hard to listen to at this point.
Yeah, but Mac, his press secretary issued something about the fact of his genius, of his intelligence. I don't know. She was saying something referring to this.
Kelly.
That was General Kelly.
They were talking about Kelly had told him to not rely. I think it was something not rely just on yes men and women to make sure you have people who push back. And she said something about
that's
him.
What he said that. Yeah,
that was the comment about Kelly couldn't handle his genius or something.
Oh, that was everything.
Yes.
I mean,
that's
so I'm I was raised in a Republican household, Mac. My parents were very, very conservative. I mean, they only listened to Rush Limbaugh. They only watched Fox News. It said English only on our front door. I mean, there were pictures of literally of Newt Gingrich and Ronald Reagan all over my house. So I'm seeped in this. I'm just trying to figure out, maybe the people that are supporting Donald Trump were never really Republicans in the sense of how I historically think of Republicans, because it seems like nothing he does offends them, because the only thing that they are Republican about is they wanted to blow up and distrust government, and Donald Trump is effectively producing the best result they have. The result isn't about trade. The result isn't about immigration. The result isn't about, you know, the wall. The result is really about destroying the concept of the federal government. Is that the success strategy for his base, as you see it, at least from an Iowa perspective?
Well, Iowa's perspective, and more broadly than that, yeah. In political science, you often run across the concept of positive government as sort of what liberalism back translates to, that is government doing things to benefit people broadly rather than, well, rich folks exclusively.
Okay.
And, yeah, I think in particular that's the ultimate target in terms of federal court appointments, the Supreme Court in particular, the lower federal courts as well, the Trump administration's been very successful, from their point of view at least, in seating the federal judiciary with people who were there deliberately to block anything that might, heaven forbid, you know, be beneficial for average people. Yeah, that has a lot to do with it. A lot of it is I think, driven by very narrow, interested, single-issue kinds of voters, things like abortion, guns. That's about all those people ever seem to think about, and so as long as he can push those buttons one way or another and acting like a strong leader, that seems to be the recipe. But the ultimate goal is to destroy this notion of positive government.
Right.
The government exists to produce progress. The thing that I have a really hard time understanding myself is that the word progressive is really like a threat to a lot of people.
Yeah.
Progress is not what they want. They want it to stay the way it is, or in many cases, I think, to go back the way it was.
Wow. So I want to end the conversation by talking a little bit about what he mentioned with the, you know, they want their guns, they want to go back, they want to do all this. So I wrote something on Facebook the other day that the Christian right and the NRA have basically been incredibly successful in now totally controlling the agenda of the Republican Party. I mean, Donald Trump doesn't have an agenda. He just basically has what he feeds to his base. And he obviously feeds them the gun line. He feeds them with the judges, especially Dean Spiliotis, what they want when it comes to, I mean, he's placed more judges on the bench than probably any president in history at this point in time, 187 judges. It's kind of frightening, and most of them probably, you know, are still in you know, wearing diapers. I mean, the younger they are, the better they are, because that means, you know, I'll be long dead before any of them step off the bench. But as I'm looking at this, I want to comment on something. The NRA, for example, is so effective in controlling not just the Republicans, but for the longest time also controlled the Democrats' ability to sort of talk about gun and gun reform. I looked at an interesting number the other day, and I have a little tiny state that considers itself very pro-gun. We have virtually no sort of gun control in the state. It turns out that only 14% of New Hampshire residents own guns. Only 14%. And of that 14%, I bet you not all of them are NRA members. I bet you maybe 2/3 are NRA members. How is it possible for so many people to be so frightened and intimidated by a group that represents less than 1 in 5 of the population? I may understand in Texas or Oklahoma or some of those other places, but I'm looking at my state. What is the power of the NRA in a place like New Hampshire when you realize their numbers are so incredibly tiny? It just shocks me, Dean.
They've had a lot of success over the years, particularly where it counts, lobbying in Washington. There's been traditionally a lot of money involved. You know, I mean, you could have a discussion about kind of the larger ethos surrounding gun ownership. And I mean, there are lots of different kinds of people who own guns.
Right.
But there also is kind of a, as you just went through, kind of a set of conservative issues that also entail Second Amendment rights.
Right.
And so a lot of these folks here, you know, maybe a small, I don't know what the percentages are, but let's assume it is, as you say, you know, they're connected into a larger community and culture.
Of issues.
Yeah, and the internet certainly facilitates all of that. And so they feel like they're part of that. So they may define their kind of way of life in the context of this larger set of issues, this larger community, not just the physical geography of New Hampshire.
Well, so but Jeffrey, when I saw 14%, I was shocked. I mean, I was shocked at how low the number was. And
yeah,
I kept
where did you see these numbers
right,
from?
So there was a, I think it was CNBC. This is really fascinating. I'll send you the link. I'll send all three of you the link, and I'll post it up on the Attitudes page. It listed the percentage of gun ownership state by state. And it turned out that the state of New Hampshire ranked 47th. 47th. And, you know, I mean, and I think in a lot of ways, by not knowing these facts, sometimes we fear the illusion of power. We fear the illusion of ownership. We fear the illusion of the threat. And if we actually know what the threat is, you know, maybe that book about Machiavelli, what we need to really learn to fear. Maybe I'm going back to how I opened this segment with that new book that's out. But Jeffrey, if you knew that, then I think you could take some of these issues to the mat and not be so afraid.
I know it's interesting because that's done nationally as well. I mean, what's the percentage of gun ownership
yes.
across the country? And that's true. I mean, and I think that Dean makes a really good point. You know, the NRA has been brilliant, at least under you know, Wayne LaPierre, of having this image of political invincibility. You know, because you know, obviously, you know, in New Hampshire, we experienced it in the '90s when Dick Sweat, who voted
right.
for that
assault weapon ban.
Rifle
right.
ban. And he was defeated,
right?
And that scared off politicians for a generation from of taking on any gun interests. I mean, I know enough about that race, and I know that the time when it was held,
yep.
that you know it was possible that he would have lost anyway,
right? But they point to that.
But they point to that
exactly, exactly.
And that's something that you know they take credit for. It's like. You know, it's like a terrorist organization taking credit for something they didn't have anything to do with. Like ISIS has done that all the time.
Yeah, exactly.
Many times.
We're taking a page out of ISIS. I love it. I love it. All right, everyone. Yes. Let me say thank you. This is Rethink the Week. Max Shelley, Jeff Feingold, Dean Spiliotis, thank you so much. We're going to end with Take Me Out to the Ball Game.
Take me out to the ball game. Take me out to the crowd. Buy me some peanuts and Cracker Jack.